Hey, I'm Ryan Reynolds.
At Mint Mobile, we like to do the opposite of what Big Wireless does. They charge you a lot, we charge you a little. So naturally, when they announced they'd be raising their prices due to inflation, we decided to deflate our prices due to not hating you. That's right. We're cutting the price of Mint Unlimited from $30 a month to just $15 a month.
Give it a try at mintmobile.com/switch.
$45 up front for 3 months plus taxes and fees. Promo rate for new customers for limited time. Unlimited more than 40 gigabytes per month slows. Full terms at mintmobile.com.
Tired of ads intruding into your favorite comedy podcasts? Good news. Ad-free listening is available on Amazon Music for all the music plus top podcasts included with your Prime membership. Dive into a world of laughs by downloading the Amazon Music app for free or go to amazon.com/comedyadfree. That's amazon.com/comedyadfree to catch up on the latest episodes without the ads.
The Michael Reed Show podcast. Tune in weekdays from 9 on LMFM. To contact us, email now, michael@lmfm.ie.
Tuesday morning, the 26th of March. Good morning. With much debate and discussion from now till 11 a.m. This is Michael Reed on LMFM. The bombs and the bullets, the tanks and the planes, and while the thoughts of fighter jets dropping weapons of mass destruction on an innocent civilian population is atrocious, we are now turning on our TVs every evening to look at a population of more than 1 million people who are on the brink of starvation. It's not that there isn't food for these people, it is that the Israelis won't let that food get to them.
In relation to the northern part of Gaza, it is absolutely essential to have a massive supply of humanitarian aid now.
Getting food and medical supplies into Gaza is not particularly complicated.
And this means opening more entry points. This means a concentration of efforts of all entities without obstacles, without limitations from the Israeli side in order to be able to rescue the people of northern Gaza of an imminent risk of famine. Many children are already today dying of hunger.
Children starving to death in Gaza. This is how Israel is executing its war with Hamas.
The decision not to allow UNRWA's convoys to go to northern Gaza, where we have a dramatic starvation situation, is totally unacceptable.
You're listening to the General Secretary of the United Nations, Antonio Guterres, condemning the Israeli decision to stop aid getting into northern Gaza.
Those that took that decision must assume the responsibility facing history of the consequences of the decision in relation to the dramatic situation of the people in northern Gaza, where, as I mentioned, we have already children dying of hunger.
Mr. Guterres was in Jordan yesterday. Meanwhile, in New York, the United Nations Security Council was asked to vote on a resolution calling for an immediate ceasefire.
We urge all members of the Security Council to support that resolution, if only to send a message that what's happening is unacceptable and what's happening has to stop. Obviously, Israel has ignored UN Security Council resolutions before. There are no indications that it will honor this one, but I think what adopting the resolution would do today is just to send a message that Israel cannot continue to with its aggression with impunity in complete disregard to international law, in complete disregard to human values, and in complete disregard to life.
The Jordanian Foreign Minister Ayman Savadi speaking ahead of that crucial United Nations vote.
Nothing can justify this collective punishment of the Palestinian people that is causing such an immense tragedy in Gaza.
Riyad Mansour, the Palestinian ambassador to the United Nations Security Council, speaking yesterday there. This time, though, he was heard. Each of the 15 members of the Security Council voted for a ceasefire, bar one.
A ceasefire could have come about months ago if Hamas had been willing to release hostages. Months ago. Instead, Hamas continues to stand in the way of peace, to throw up roadblocks, cower in tunnels beneath Gaza cities and behind under civilian infrastructure and hide among the civilian population.
America's support for Israel may have been diluted somewhat, but yesterday the US ambassador laid blame squarely at the door of Hamas and abstained from voting for a ceasefire.
Colleagues, we appreciated the willingness of members of this council to take some of our edits and improve on this resolution. Still, certain key edits were ignored, including our request to add a condemnation of Hamas. And we did not agree with everything in the resolution. For that reason, we were unfortunately not able to vote yes. However, as I've said before, we fully support some of the critical objectives in this non-binding resolution.
Linda Thomas-Greenfield. But despite the US abstaining from calling for a ceasefire, 14 of the 15 members of the United Nations Security Council voted in favor.
Mr. President, it has taken 6 months, over 100,000 Palestinians killed and maimed, 2 million displaced, and famine for this council to finally demand an immediate ceasefire. A vote for humanity to prevail, for life to prevail.
The Palestinian ambassador Riyad Mansour once again there. Now, as news of the United Nations Security Council calling for a ceasefire in Gaza was coming through to us yesterday, I spoke to Caoimhe de Barra, the CEO of TROCRA, who welcomed the result.
Yes, we absolutely welcome it. And this is very important because the US abstained rather than blocking it. It is very important that this resolution has finally been passed. We're now in 5.5 months of war in Gaza. And it really has been just quite alarming that the UN Security Council, which is meant to protect international peace, has not been able to date, secure a simple resolution calling for a ceasefire. But now that that has been passed, that will increase the pressure on Israel. And this is important because as things stand, the behaviour of the Israeli Defence Forces continues to worsen with respect to the civilian population of Gaza. So, for example, the UNRWA, which is the UN's largest organization and mechanism to distribute aid in Gaza, was told categorically by Israel in the last 2 days that it will not any longer approve the delivery of any food convoys by UNRWA to northern Gaza. So that means that UNRWA, which has not had any food convoy approved since late January, now knows that no food convoys will be approved. And this is in the context of the UN having declared just 1 week ago that 1.1 million people, including the population of northern Gaza, are facing famine right now, and that by mid-May, that 1.1 million people could be experiencing full famine conditions, which will spread to the rest of the population unless there is a huge surge in humanitarian aid and unimpeded access for that aid. So the ceasefire is very welcome because it further increases the pressure on Israel to enable humanitarian aid to get through to all of the people who need it so desperately in Gaza.
That's if there's to be a ceasefire. 15 countries make up the United Nations Security Council. All of them, bar the United States, voted in favour of this motion. The American motion on Friday fell short because it didn't call for a ceasefire, amongst other things. And the Arabic countries seem to be of the opinion that the United States, in its resolution, really was attributing a lot of the blame for this to Hamas and didn't seem too critical to their eyes of Israel. Do you believe that there's enough pressure on Israel now to result in a ceasefire?
I think, unfortunately, the behaviour that we have seen from the current Israeli government it continues to give a lot of cause for concern because they are not responding to international pressure. And the reality is that the United States is the only country that actually can exert more pressure. The United States is funding the Israeli Defense Forces and its military operations, and has massively increased that funding since the 7th of October. And this is in a manner which is completely disproportionate. The reality is that the ceasefire agreement, the resolution at the UN Security Council, is very important. The US having abstained rather than blocking that ceasefire is significant because it illustrates that the US is increasingly extremely frustrated with Israel and with the current government of Israel's stance around Gaza and Rafah. For months, the US has been saying that the civilian casualties are far too high. The reality is that there are rules around war and how any war should be conducted, and any war should be proportionate, as in the damage to civilian life and infrastructure must be proportionate to the legitimate aims of the war, and they are completely disproportionate. 32,000 people have been killed, countless thousands have been injured and will never recover either from direct physical injury or from the trauma that 2.2 million people are experiencing. So what needs to happen now is the US needs to go a step further and really examine the financing that it is giving to Israel, specifically the military financing that has increased massively since the 7th of October. And this is enabling Israel to continue to prosecute a war in defiance of international humanitarian law and in defiance of international public opinion.
In terms of proportionality, what's your view, Caoimhe, in terms of blocking aid going into any area, in this case, North Gaza? Is it something that you'd liken to a weapon of war? Is it like a bullet or a bomb? Are the Israelis effectively killing innocent civilians?
It is absolutely a war crime because it is against international humanitarian law to deprive civilians of the objects that are indispensable to their survival. There is no food getting through to northern Gaza. Israel has just said it will not allow UNRWA, the largest UN operator, to deliver food to northern Gaza. That is tantamount to a death sentence for the people of northern Gaza. So depriving people of access to food is a war crime. It is unjustifiable and it is illegal.
Do you hope that Hamas will accept the terms of the ceasefire that the United States has been negotiating with Qatar and Israel, I think?
Oh, absolutely. It's imperative that the ceasefire is reached and is agreed. And it's imperative that Hamas is held to account for the atrocities that it has committed, without question. The release of the hostages absolutely must be seen. It is appalling how almost 6 months on, so many hostages are still detained and their families are without information or knowledge of where they are or whether they are still alive. But also, all illegally detained persons in Gaza must be released. There are many thousands of people, according to what we're hearing, who have been arrested by the Israeli Defense Forces, and their whereabouts is unknown. Their well-being is also unknown. So the release of hostages and all illegally detained persons is absolutely essential. Hamas must be held to account. The government of Israel must be held to account. And ultimately, this ceasefire, which hopefully we will see soon, must amount to a longer-term agreement to achieve a just peace so that the rights of Palestinians and the legitimate rights of Israelis can be respected and promoted.
And do you believe that the Americans could actually be doing more than they are? And if so, why so? And the reason I ask you that is because I think there's a lot of people who would say that you can't become the president of the United States without the Jewish vote. I was speaking with Larry Donnelly, who's an esteemed commentator on American politics on the program yesterday, and how Joe Biden, the president of America, has become known as Genocide Joe through various protests across this country. But he said, if you think Joe Biden is Genocide Joe, well, maybe you are better off with the devil that you know, sort of thing, in that what's coming next, the alternative, Trump and his regime, could be a whole lot worse.
So from our perspective as a humanitarian agency, what is most important is the rights and obligations on states, regardless of who the leader of that state at any moment is. So states, every state that has signed up to the Genocide Convention and at the Geneva Conventions on how war must be prosecuted, if it is to happen at all, they have obligations. So the Genocide Convention makes it an obligation on any state party to prevent genocide or the risk of genocide. So the US, in funding and arming the Israeli Defense Forces to prosecute a war which is clearly disproportionate, really there are legal risks to that state, regardless of who becomes president in November of this year. And the same question must be asked of all states, so the European Union member states, even our own country. We must make sure that we do everything in our power to prevent the risk of genocide. And depriving people of food, depriving people of humanitarian assistance, if it's intentionally targeted to wipe out a whole people, that is the hallmark of genocide. And this is why the case that the ICJ is looking at, the International Court of Justice, is so important. They found that there were grounds to investigate in terms of whether genocide is happening in Israel. And Israel has clearly refused to implement the measures that they put in place at the end of January, which included protecting civilians from harm. And what we have seen since then is the deaths of thousands more civilians and the number of children, for example, at risk of starvation doubling.
All right. Now, I see the Israelis, as we speak, hoping for a ceasefire, are surrounding the two hospitals in Khan Yunis. If there was to be a ceasefire in the morning, or a permanent ceasefire, let's say, in the morning, and we can only hope for such a thing, what's your feeling on how long it would take the people in Gaza to get over this? Trokra is in every war-torn country in the world, every country affected by famine, and indeed some of the world's worst problems. People there helped by the good work that Trokra does. But there's so much has happened in Gaza at this stage. Surely it would take years for people to put this behind them, if it's ever possible to do that psychologically.
So I think the last word you said there are very important. If it is ever possible to do this psychologically, you have 2.2 million people trapped in Gaza. They cannot leave. They have been enduring this war, surviving at the very best for almost 6 months. The trauma, half of them are children. The trauma will never leave. Trauma creates a residual effect that people carry from generation to generation. So the people of Gaza will literally, in terms of the future that we can imagine, never recover from this. Also, physically, the country has been obliterated. If you look at maps and images, you can see the extent of damage done. You can see the buildings that have been obliterated. The shelling has destroyed 70% of buildings in most of Gaza, including residential buildings, but also schools, hospitals, everything that people rely on, the water infrastructure. So the concept of how to reconstruct, should there be an opportunity to do this, is just unfathomably large. It is absolutely immense. And that's why every day that passes that more damage is done really is just shocking and appalling, because so much has been done already that the reconstruction of people's infrastructure, their homes, their lives, their mental health and well-being, it becomes more unimaginable every day how that's going to be achieved. And really, it is beyond urgent at this stage. This ceasefire, which we hope will come into place soon, could not be more urgent.
Caoimhe Dabara, who is the CEO of Trokra, was speaking to me yesterday. If you'd like to comment on the programme today, as always, we'd love to hear from you. You can ring us on 041 983 2000, text or WhatsApp 086 1800 658, email michael@lmfm.ie.
Michael Reid on LMFM.
What is sexual consent? Well, a year ago, the Dublin Rape Crisis Centre launched the We Consent campaign. The objective is to raise awareness of consent and how sex must always be consensual. It's launched the third tranche of research this week that it has taken, and this time the focus has been been on the public's understanding of sexual consent, which has improved in the course of a year. 47% of people surveyed say that they have a better understanding today of what consent means than would have been the case 12 months ago. 48% of those who were surveyed have a more positive attitude towards consent compared to a year ago. 630 adults were surveyed and they were asked several questions. One of them was whether they agreed with the statement, "Everyone has the right to change their mind at any point during a sexual encounter, no matter how far it's gone." 76% strongly agreed with that, and that's an increase from 62% in 2021. 84% agreed that they would prefer to stop things if they suspected their partner was not enjoying a sexual encounter, and that's up from 76%. But as I'm sure you've been hearing, there was another question asked of the 630 adults who were surveyed. They were asked to agree with this statement or not. I'd probably keep going if I suspect my partner is not enjoying a sexual encounter. And 1 in 5 or 20% of the men who were surveyed under the age of 45 agreed with that. In other words, they would continue if their partner was not enjoying a sexual encounter. Let's speak to Sarah Monaghan, who is the We Consent Project Manager for the Dublin Rape Crisis Centre. And a very good morning to you, Sarah, and thank you indeed for joining us on the programme this morning. I think most people, particularly women, will be particularly shocked by that finding in your survey.
Yeah, and good morning, Michael. Thanks for having me on. So, yes, I suppose I'll pick up that 1 in 5 men under 45. First, this is obviously very concerning to us, and it certainly highlights that for some men under 45, they very much still need additional support when it comes to understanding the dynamics and grasping the importance of consent and how it is vital in every single sexual encounter. So the safety and enjoyment of all parties really need to be equalised during any sexual encounter, and the fact that we see that one party would continue when they are aware that the other person is not enjoying the encounter is not acceptable. You know, regular check-ins can so easily be built into sex, and rather than, you know, ruining the mood, which is something we hear a lot, they are almost guaranteed to do the opposite and actually ensure that everyone has a more enjoyable sexual encounter, and it was even more importantly in lots of ways a safer sexual encounter. So I think, you know, some of the earlier statistics you mentioned there, they absolutely represent a move in the right direction, which is encouraging, and it does show that the Irish public are ready and willing and well able to engage with this topic, you know, and understand that it's so important for us to do so. But it also shows us that we've a lot more work to do in supporting some cohorts of the population to understand consent better and to really understand how it impacts their lives and how, you know, they have a role within this.
And 1 in 5 people who you surveyed said that people will say no to sex when they really mean yes and they're just looking to be convinced. This is like something out of a Benny Hill episode. No, yes. Would I be wrong if I was to read that statement instead of saying 1 in 5 of those surveyed to say 1 in 5 men believe that people say no to sex when they want to be convinced?
So this, so it's a statistic that's in front of us that is of the entire sample, which was actually 823 people. But we definitely, I think, see it present that little bit more in men. I think, you know, we have, unfortunately, all of those everyday cultural norms, you know, that really have an impact on how men understand sex and relationships, and indeed all of us in the population. Historically, for instance, you know, men have been told that they need to be the one to initiate sex, that they're the pursuer, that they have to be assertive, that they are to push for a yes. And they're often told that women will refuse but want to be convinced. And all of these old myths are 100% incorrect. They are very much outdated, and this was worst of all, they're deeply harmful, and they lead to very harmful negative outcomes. And I suppose it's incumbent on all of us and on every man in today's society to update those myths, you know, to delete them from the back catalogue within their brain, and to learn more and to do better when it comes to disputing these myths, both within themselves, you know, to learn more and think about whether these types of beliefs serve them well and serve others well, and also to dispute them with those around them and start having conversations and start, you know, really moving, I suppose, into the modern day where this is, you know, absolutely not the type of behaviour we want.
Mm. I said at the outset, Sarah, that one of the objectives of your campaign is to make us all aware of the fact that sex must always be consensual, because that is a fact, because it is the law. But your survey has found that not everybody thinks that way.
Yes, absolutely. And look, that, you know, that is very much, I suppose, why we do this work, is to work on that preventative side of sexual violence. You know, a lot of our work in the Dublin Crisis Centre happens in the aftermath of sexual violence, in supporting people and healing the trauma that people, survivors and victims experience. But the We Consent campaign is about prevention, and it is about engaging people in conversation, an open and honest conversation, sometimes for the first time. And while, I suppose, we hear a lot about consent as a term and a topic nowadays, it's still, you know, finding its feet and finding ground in terms of people really engaging with it. I think a lot of the time people consider it as something important, but something quite abstract, something that, you know, someone else's problem, it's for someone else to think about. Oftentimes we hear that it's, you know, something people only think about in terms of youth and, you know, young people. But really, this campaign is all about recognising that no matter your age or your gender or your, you know, relationship status, that this is for all of us. Like, none of us can afford to opt out of engaging with this conversation, because the impact of a lack of consent, or the impact of those myths and those misconceptions about sexual violence, are just so harmful. And given that we see, you know, 4 in 10 people in Ireland, as per the last CSO research, have experienced sexual violence in their lifetime, you know, it's extremely likely that someone you care about has been harmed by a lack of consent. And so they need you to play a role by learning more about this issue and talking about it with others, whether that's friends or family or colleagues or your own partner. You know, that we're just, I suppose, moving away from that space that we had historically in Ireland of being very ashamed and silent about these issues, but that we're bringing them very much out into the open now.
But 1 in 5 of the people surveyed said that you can have sex without full consent and it's not rape. Are they wrong? Is it rape if there isn't full consent?
Well, yes. I mean, as per the law, if consent is not present, then it is rape. I think what that statistic really shows us and opens up for us is that there is such confusion there around sexual violence, around consent, and around what constitutes rape. I think we're used to thinking about sexual violence in quite narrow parameters. We think about strangers and, you know, dark alleyways and that kind of thing, you know, comes to mind, when actually sexual violence, you know, very often happens, you know, within a home. It happens with somebody that you know already. It may be a partner, it may be, you know, an acquaintance of yours. And it also, sexual violence constitutes more than rape itself. It constitutes all sexual violence, whether that is, you know, sexual harassment on the street, whether that's coercive control, whether that's, you know, being touched without your consent. I think it's much, much broader than people initially consider. And I think that statistic really hits on that a little bit, that we are still not fully understanding what sexual violence is and therefore what consent is.
And rape is rape. There can't be a little bit of rape, or whatever way people might justify it in their own minds. And 1 in 5 of the people that you surveyed are raping other people, or believe that they can have sex without full consent. Well, then we're talking about a lot of rapists or potential rapists. And that works both ways, doesn't it? Because there's victims as well.
There is. And I think, you know, what's important to think about is whether, even if there is not intent to cause harm, even if people in their own mind don't think that they are committing that crime due to the fact that they've somehow entirely misunderstood, you know, what sexual violence and what rape is, the impact is the same, you know, and the impact on a victim or a survivor is the same. And it's really about us prioritising that at all times. So in every sexual encounter, we are prioritising the well-being of the person that we're with and ensuring that they are okay and that they're, you know, feeling safe and feeling that they can say no, that they can, you know, change course, that they can change their mind at any time, because that is the priority. And so those regular check-ins and that, those regular conversations and communication, they have to be, you know, a central part of all of our sexual encounters, whether that's a short, you know, part of a short-term relationship or whether it's part of a marriage of 50 years. And that's something that we see come up, you know, quite a bit, is that people think about consent differently when they've been married for, you know, a long time. And we see that come up in our workshops all of the time, where people see it as something else, that because they're married for a long time, there's a routine. And that routine becomes, you know, kind of laden with a lot of expectation, a lot of assumption about sex and consent, when those conversations have to still be a part of, you know, your interaction and your relationship.
Is there an acceptance on the part of the victim in those circumstances where
a woman
says, well, you know, it's not the first time he's done it. I told him no, but sure, we'll get on with it. Or because they're married, that it's somehow okay or more acceptable than if it was a stranger who had attacked them.
I think what we see and we saw it in the research is that a third of people agree that having sex is just part of a long-term relationship. You know, that you're not always up for it, but you'd go along with it, was the line that people agreed with. So a third of people is extremely significant. And I think it's become something that is quite accepted within marriage. I think there's a lot of nuance there that people, you know, feel for a whole host of different reasons that they just go along with it rather than opening up the conversation. And, you know, we see clients in the Dublin Rape Crisis Centre from across all age groups and from across all demographics, and, you know, who have been married for 50 years and people who've been together once. So no matter what, those conversations are just so, so important. And I suppose also thinking about that nobody, you would hope, in those relationships, you know, want anyone to feel unsafe, want anyone to feel, you know, unhappy with the dynamics that are at play. So that opening up that conversation is actually good for everybody involved.
You started your work a year ago. Over the course of the year, you've had 1,000 people walk through conversation workshops, and you've another 12 months ahead where you'll continue with this project and this objective of trying to raise awareness of what consent means, and that it must always be fully consensual. Do you believe that it's possible to get to a stage where all, if not almost all, of the people in the country understand the responsibilities that they have?
Yeah, I am hopeful, Michael. I suppose, you know, when we're working in this sphere, we need to be hopeful. I think that already within the research there, the general public are very much showing their capacity and their willingness to engage with this. And we've seen that in our direct engagement with people over the last year, you know, through those 1,000 people who've gone to workshops, through the people we engage with through our websites, through our social media, through loads of different events and spheres. People are ready to talk about this, possibly more than ever before. I think, you know, that the long-term objective for this campaign is that we lower rates of sexual violence, full stop, and that there is, you know, less of a need for the services of organisations like the Dublin Rape Crisis Centre. But that is a long-term objective that takes time. Cultural change very much takes time, and, you know, needs to work hand-in-hand with legal change and curriculum change and all those other areas. But I am hopeful that we will very much get there.
Okay. Sarah, when we speak about sexual assault or rape for that matter, I'm always aware that somebody is listening to us suffering silently, quite possibly, and we just like to mention to them that there is help at hand. The Dublin Rape Crisis National Helpline is open 24 hours a day. It's free of charge, and you can speak to a trained counsellor at 1800 77 88 88. That's 1800 77 88 88. And thank you indeed for joining us on the programme today, Sarah. Sarah Monaghan is the We Consent Project Manager with the Dublin Rape Crisis Centre.
Michael Reid on LMFM.
Deirdre has been in touch with us this morning saying if women say no to sex, men should respect what she wants. I think, Deirdre, that should go without saying, but well worth saying today. And thank you indeed for sending your text to us, 086 1800 658 086 1800 658. If you want to text or WhatsApp us, 041 983 2000, or phone number, email michael@lmfm.ie. Thomas in touch with us saying it's very disturbing to watch television these days, and the scenes coming from Gaza, people begging for food that isn't there or soon won't be, animal feed being mixed with food to make it stretch so that whatever food there is there will last longer. But children are already dying of starvation. Genocide, Joey says, and the United States and Israel should hang their heads in shame. Genocide, Joe, being Joe Biden, the president of the United States of America. And indeed, as we've been hearing this morning, America abstained in that vote calling for a ceasefire in Gaza, which was carried by a huge majority of 14 out of the 15 nations that make up the Security Council. But the United States abstaining and making the point that it felt was very important to make, that Hamas carried out an atrocity. It's hard to understand, but as I was saying to Caoimhe de Barra earlier on, perhaps there's something in the point that Larry Donnelly made on the programme yesterday. If you think Joe Biden or Genocide Joe or whatever way you want to describe the president is bad now, wait until the next fella, Donald Trump, if he ends up being the next president of the United States. Betty Daly in touch with us today too. Good morning to Betty, and thanks for your text. She says, Mike, on the subject of sex and consent, let's not forget that there's a child who may be conceived in error in circumstances like that. Thanks, Betty, for that. I think all thought goes out the door in that moment of self-gratification, really. I mean, if there isn't consent, I don't know if there's much difference. Is there? Maybe you tell me, is there much difference between masturbation or a blow-up doll or something like that? I mean, it's crude. I know it's crude, but is that what the man is doing, objectifying the woman in the same way? That she's kind of irrelevant? She's just a tool? I don't know. Thanks to Peter, who says, looking forward to hearing the conversation on oversubscribed schools. I'm at the end of my tether, thinking about where we're going to send our young teenage daughter when it comes time to go to secondary school, because it seems there are no places available anywhere. We'll be talking about that in the second hour. Thanks for that. Our phone number, as I say, 0419832000. Text or WhatsApp 086 1800 658. Email michael@lmfm.ie.
Michael Reed on LMFM.
This Saturday is World Bipolar Day. This week, AWARE is hoping to help us better understand the bipolar condition and eliminate social stigma and also promote acceptance of the disease. We're joined by Dr. Susan Brannick, who's the clinical director at AWARE. And a very good morning to you, Susan. Thank you indeed for joining us on the programme today.
Good morning, Michael.
Bipolar is a complicated disease. And am I right in thinking it's one that's hard to diagnose?
Yeah, absolutely. And thank you for having me on this morning to talk about it for a little while. So it can be hard to diagnose for people. For some people, it can be between 8 and 10 years to get a diagnosis. I suppose at AWARE, we really wanted to kind of dedicate this week, as you said, to World Bipolar Day on the 30th, really to raise information and awareness about the condition. So certainly if someone is experiencing experiences of low mood, let's say, or quite extreme changes in mood with what we might consider highs as well as significant lows, it might be something that's worth talking to the GP about in order to find out whether that diagnosis might be applicable here. So it can be difficult to diagnose, but after diagnosis, when treated with perhaps medication or talking therapy, it can be very possible to live well with bipolar disorder, you know?
Even what you've just said is difficult to understand, I think, for a lot of us, because we all have good days and bad days, don't we?
Yeah, absolutely. We all have good days and bad days and a range of different emotions and feelings and experiences throughout the day. I suppose the thing with bipolar disorder is that it's very different to just the normal kind of range of changes in mood. So there can be, in bipolar disorder, very significant or very extreme low periods as well as high periods too. So that's the difference. So it's much more serious than kind of changes in mood, if that makes sense.
Mm.
If you all might experience day to day.
If untreated, is it dangerous?
It's not, I guess, if untreated, the person may experience periods of low mood that aren't resolved or periods of high mood that aren't resolved. I guess the idea about the treatment and diagnosis is that some people can live well with the condition. I suppose it's possible that if it goes untreated or isn't managed very well, the person is going to suffer for quite a long time, unnecessarily potentially. So I guess that's the kind of key part about having a diagnosis, that then the kind of correct treatment path can be identified.
Mm. And that it will continue if it goes untreated. And what's involved in the treatment?
Sure. So the treatment will be discussed, as I was saying, so kind of the diagnosis might happen after a GP appointment. So the GP might be able to link someone in with a mental health service, and then they'll be able to meet with a psychiatrist and a multidisciplinary team. So typically, people living with bipolar may well be supported by a multidisciplinary team. So that just means in a mental health service that you would have psychiatry, psychologists, as well as OT and social workers. So that is kind of a different range of experience. The treatment can involve medication for many people to help kind of manage mood, as well as cognitive behavioural therapy. And really key in terms of living well with bipolar disorders is information and what we might call self-management about the condition. So understanding what it's like for you as an individual, as well as how to kind of develop strategies to manage periods of low or periods of where the mood can be higher. You know, and in Aware, we run a Living Well with Bipolar group, which is a self-management group, which is really unique across the country, you know. So that's a free 8-week group that people with this diagnosis can access information and support and really learn more about their conditions. That's in person and online.
Mm.
And for anyone who's interested in that, they can find a bit more on our website on aware.ie.
Mm, absolutely. I believe there's also a group for relatives and friends who may be finding it difficult to come to terms with the fact that someone close to them has bipolar, or indeed to cope with the impact of that. Again, more details on that program through aware.ie. Aware runs so many good programs and offers so much help to people, which cannot go unsaid. But when we talk about people who are bipolar, and you're talking about eliminating the stigma attached to it, I think people will be surprised to hear about some of the people who have had bipolar, well-known names through history. The most obvious of all is Vincent van Gogh.
Mm, yeah, and that certainly said, so obviously diagnosed kind of after his death, but that's where the World Bipolar Day came from, I suppose, in a sense of kind of starting to name the condition and really, as you say, reduce the stigma. So stigma is a huge problem, not just for bipolar disorder, but for mental health conditions more generally. You know, we're doing a lot better in Ireland, I think, in terms of talking about our mental health and being more open about it, but we still have a lack of services and kind of adequate kind of support. I suppose it's where Aware kind of comes in to try to support people who might be living with that condition. But stigma is a huge problem. You know, it can affect how well people can live with the condition. Some people say stigma is maybe worse than having the mental health condition itself, you know. So it might be in terms of how people respond to someone with bipolar or a different mental health condition, or it might be how the person sees themselves, the kind of messages that they hear that they might then internalize or make personal to themselves, you know. So stigma is a huge problem in terms of mental health more generally. As I said, I think we're doing a bit better, but we still have a fair way to go.
Rebag, your premier destination for luxury resale. Elevate your style with our curated collection of bags, watches, and fine jewelry. At Rebag, quality is our priority. Each piece meticulously vetted and verified by experts, ensuring your investment is nothing short of perfection. Buy and sell finds from the world's top brands, including Hermes, Chanel, and Cartier. Access expertly crafted and hard-to-find pieces that redefine luxury. Your next investment awaits at Rebag. Get 10% off your first purchase with code REBAG10. That's 10% off the luxury you deserve. Don't miss out. Head to Rebag.com and enter code REBAG10 at checkout. That's REBAG10.
Selling a little or a lot? Shopify helps you do your thing however you cha-ching. Shopify is the global commerce platform that helps you sell at every stage of your business. From the launch your online shop stage to the first real-life store stage. All the way to the did we just hit a million orders stage. Shopify is there to help you grow. Shopify helps you turn browsers into buyers with the internet's best converting checkout. 36% better on average compared to other leading commerce platforms. Because businesses that grow, grow with Shopify. Get a $1 per month trial period at shopify.com/work. Shopify.com/work.
Tired of ads intruding into your favorite comedy podcasts? Good news. Ad-free listening is available on Amazon Music for all the music plus top podcasts included with your Prime membership. Dive into a world of laughs by downloading the Amazon Music app for free or go to amazon.com/comedyadfree. That's amazon.com/comedyadfree to catch up on the latest episodes without the ads.
Where does awareness usually stem from? Is this the person who has bipolar disease, or would it tend to be somebody else who points it out, friends or family for that matter, who can see that there's these mood swings? As you say, they're not just the type of highs and lows that we all experience on a day-to-day basis, one good day, one bad day, but feelings of very high elation and then followed by depressive moods, as the case may be. Is that something that's noticed by people other than the patient, do you think, more so than the patient themselves?
Yeah. And I guess the same, they may not necessarily be followed, or it might not be a high and then a low. It can be really different for different people, you know. Many people with bipolar might experience quite long periods of quite extreme low mood. They may have shorter periods of kind of that more elated mood, I suppose. The thing I would say, maybe for someone who might be thinking, oh, I wonder, does that sound a bit like what I might experience, or someone who might just be struggling more generally, I suppose you're the person who's going to know quite well if you're experiencing difficulty, if you're struggling or if you're suffering. I suppose in a way, we'd really encourage people to not do that alone. So if there is someone that you can speak to, that might be someone in, you know, a partner, a friend, or kind of someone that you can trust. It may well be a GP if you're really worried about your mental health. I guess I would really encourage people to connect and reach out for help if they are struggling. So if life isn't feeling worthwhile, or if you're feeling very low, or if your moods are feeling very unmanageable, that you feel like this doesn't feel right, you know what I mean? I'm not able to live the life that I want to live. They're the kind of pointers that you as an individual might be listening to and thinking, okay, so maybe it might be worth seeking some help and support for this, I guess. As I said, in AWARE, our message really is one of recovery and hope, you know, that it's, you don't have to suffer alone in this or long term. I guess the other piece that you mentioned is kind of wondering if someone in your life might be experiencing difficulty. I suppose that maybe if you have a solid enough relationship, it might be worth asking them how they're doing, if they're feeling okay, you know, and kind of supporting them in whatever they need, whether it's maybe support in getting to a GP or doing something different. I guess the first kind of question maybe to do is to sort of ask. And I guess that's the key part in the stigma and the anti-stigma campaigns as well. It's to kind of be having these conversations, not from a place of judgment or kind of criticism, but I suppose it's connecting in. If someone that you love seems to be struggling or suffering, it's probably a good port of call to kind of check in with them. And then take it from there, you know.
Okay. And 1-2% of us, or 1 in 50 people, suffer from bipolar. People can follow the AWARE campaign on social media under the hashtag #BipolarTogether. Saturday is World Bipolar Day. And more information, as you mentioned earlier on, from the AWARE website, aware.ie. Thank you indeed for joining us on the programme today. That's Dr. Susan Brannick, Clinical Director at AWARE. As always, if you want to comment on the programme today, we'd love to hear from you. 0419832000 is our telephone number. You can text us on 086 1800 658, email michael@lmfm.ie.
Michael Reed on LMFM.
Getting a school place for your children may be impossible in the coming years, as highlighted in the Irish Times. A lot of the schools in the country are already oversubscribed. So what are you going to do? How will your children go to school if there isn't a place for them? I'm not sure that anybody can square that circle, but let's talk about some of the concern that undoubtedly parents have at this stage. Rory O'Murcu, Sinn Féin TD for Louth and East Meath, joins us. Good morning to you. Thank you indeed for joining us. There are particular problems locally, aren't there, with a lot of the local schools oversubscribed?
Yeah, no, look, this is frightening stuff, you know, and people would have anecdotally told you about cases that they were worried in relation to their kids and whether they would actually get the, you know, a position within schools. And obviously people have particular traditions of their kids going to certain schools. They obviously have siblings in certain schools. They obviously live very close to certain schools, and on, you know, and this is obviously an unpublished Department of Education report that was released. And the fact is, it stated that the Dundalk Grammar School, St Mary's College, College of Reach were oversubscribed for next September, and College de Cúchulainn was fully subscribed. Mm. And then the information was unknown in relation to St Vincent's and the Bush. I think it's only De Louis, which is 490 students, and O'Fee with 289 students were undersubscribed. So look, you have a huge level of worry.
It gets worse than that, in actual fact. Because that's the situation in the Dundalk area. When you come out of Dundalk and go across County Louth and indeed into County Meath, the only hope of getting a school place at this stage, apart from the Louis and Dundalk, would be St Joseph's in Navan or Scoil I Mhíre in Dunleary, yes.
Yeah, and then you're into the whole issue in relation to bus transport system and all the rest of it, and the scheme and all the issues that exist. And that's long before, Michael, we deal with the issue that we've often spoken about before, about those parents who are dealing with kids with additional needs, who need added resources and all the rest of it, and the lack of places there are, the lack of autism units, and you know, and all the issues in relation to schools and being able to get assessments from a point of view of ensuring that they can get special needs assistance and whatever else. Yeah. And we've been and for ages, look, we all know the information is out there, whether we're talking about the census information, whether we're talking about the information that the departments have. We're all talking about modelling that is based on demographics and growth and whatever. But I think what we can see here is that the modelling system that we're operating obviously isn't producing the results that we need. I also know from talking to many principals, even when units or new buildings are in train, that there's a particular issue that they do not have the control that they would have had previously in relation to arranging these bills. So therefore, they have to talk to somebody in the department that they may or not be able to get. They need to be able to talk to somebody as regards consultants. Then also things can change that are outside of their control. And then they're hoping to God that nothing holds up on the basis of the planning process or in relation to any other logistics that are outside of their control, that they would have said previously they would have had a more hands-on position in relation to it.
Okay. So look, well, when we talk about schools being fully subscribed or oversubscribed, a lot of the people listening to us will have already signed their children up for places in those schools. But there is a serious question, isn't there, about people who move into the area, and you're always going to have that. As you say, in the Dundalk area, the De La Salle is not known. Perhaps there's places, perhaps not. It's the same with Vincent's. We know that the Louis is undersubscribed. So there's a chance of getting a place there, or in St Joseph's in Navan, or in Scoil I Mhíre in Dunleer. But what happens if somebody moves into Drogheda? There isn't a school place anywhere nearby, and this stretches down to Bettystown. All of the school places are oversubscribed or fully subscribed, and they're about to build 5,000 houses with 20,000 new people coming into the town. Where's the thought and planning gone into this?
That's what I was about to say. First of all, we've had a huge amount of people that have moved into Drogheda in the last while, because it's still in, for the want of a better term, shooting distance of Dublin and whatever else. We know that we're dealing with the issues of house prices. See those houses you're talking about? We need to see them as soon as possible. We know the particular needs that we have, but I do not, as much as you'll put in parliamentary questions, you'll get answers in relation to modelling, planning, and that everything is happening right at this point in time. But what you're seeing is a system that is not in any way able to cope with what we have at the minute, never mind what we could be dealing with into the future. So we need to get real about it. And as I say, then there are the logistical issues, even when you get through planning, even when you have everything in place in relation to resources. And we all know from time to time that schools are dealing with an issue of where they had told parents that they will have new buildings for the next September, it then ends up getting stalled. So it's the September after that. And in some cases, that's the autism unit that is no longer available. And then you have parents running around willy-nilly. We have to look at what we do in relation to obviously planning into the future. We also have to look at how we deal with the emissions process. As I say, I think there's a very specific piece of work that needs to be done with those with additional needs. But we're talking about here just across the board that we might not have sufficient places for all those people out there. Now, the other thing is, because some of this happens, I assume a lot of people are half hoping that, you know, there may be multiple applications, that, you know, some people may get a school that they want, the positions will open in other schools, but none of it's good enough, none of it's clear enough. And, you know, you were dealing with the issue in relation to obviously mental health issues and whatever previously. The fact is, this is another case of due to lack of planning, due to lack of foresight, due to lack of resources, where we're going to put children and we're also going to put through their parents through a huge level of anxiety and worry to hopefully end up in a better circumstance. But like, we need to just deal with this with a better system. And look, as I say, there's no shortage of information in relation to where population is going. As you say, you're talking about the fact that we all know that these houses are going to be built, and that, you know, the changes in relation to the port access Northern Cross route, the other plans that are in place in Drogheda and throughout this county. But see if we're not fit to deal with who we, you know, with the amount of kids that are coming through at the minute. How are we going to deal with this? And we're going to, and in fairness, people who are doing their absolute damnedest, they're out working every day, and they're trying to choose a community, they're trying to choose an area where they can afford to buy a house, and they would expect on some level that you would be able to provide them with a school place. Like, you're talking about the stuff we could do, and I guess that we didn't have the same population, but you're talking about stuff that we could deliver upon once upon a time with very little resources. You know, so
it's little wonder
we really need to get back together.
It's little wonder that parents are frustrated, and it's not just parents who are frustrated, because hard-working school managers, board members and campaigners are frustrated too. That's according to David Graham, who's the chairperson of the Board of Management for the Malahide Port Marnock Educate Together School in Swords. As I mentioned earlier on, this problem was highlighted by the Irish Times, and he's written to the Irish Times, his letter is published today, about his school, saying that 8 years after a campaign for a new school, only the first phase has been built. The timelines for the second phase of the build remain unclear. They were told that they're going to get prefabs for the next intake of students in September. It feels like we're going backwards, and that it should not take 10 years or more to build a school. Our students deserve better. That sounds perfectly reasonable, common sense, as articulated by David Graham in his letter.
It's absolutely reasonable. What it also is ridiculous that he thinks what he has to do is write to the Irish Times. No different than we have had schools that have been in and have been advocating, you know, outside and inside Leinster House, and obviously utilising politicians like myself and others in relation to having their say. But like as I've often said, it's an absolute failure of the system when you have to come to TDs in relation to dealing what are very, very, what would have been once upon a time simple issues in relation to that we have some element of planning on. We know the population's going to increase. We know the demographics of the kids that are coming through. We know that there's an increased amount of those with additional needs. We have building, even where it has been agreed to, but that there is a slowness in relation to the management of it. And as I say, we've taken the powers away sometimes from schools, and then we just leave them in a circumstance where they can't even give the answers because they're not aware of the information, even to parents. And everyone is getting absolutely frayed in relation to this. And as I say, these are the straightforward scenarios. It shouldn't come as any shock that, you know, you have to provide primary, secondary school before and even beyond that as regards educational resources. So it's absolutely scandalous. And the fact that we can't even deal with the situation of, as I say, plans that are put in place for new school buildings, and everything always ends up becoming a mess that comes to politicians that me or somebody else has to advocate on, and I'm only too delighted to do it. And I'll be honest.
We called the fire brigade to put out the fire instead of making sure that the fire never started. And you exactly. you say people are calling you. But what can TDs do? There's another letter in the Irish Times today about this. I'm not sure if you've seen it, Rory, but it's from a Louis O'Flaherty in Santry who talks about Carlo O'Brien, who wrote this story in the Irish Times. He's the education editor, and how there's no places for his children in Greystones. And Louis O'Flaherty says, is it not strange that this can happen in a constituency that returns five TDs representing five different political parties, including two locals who are government ministers? It's across the country. Obviously, as we've learned from the Irish Times, three out of four parents are not able to secure spots because schools are oversubscribed at this stage. It doesn't bode well, does it, for children coming up now looking for secondary school places?
Of course it doesn't. And at this stage, unfortunately, in relation to the political system and the fact that we've had abject failure from, you know, multiple governments, and I'll say, like, here over many, many years, Fianna Fáil and Fine Gael, and like, we're looking at continuity of this government, that we're looking at another Fine Gael Taoiseach being elected. You know, and I know from on the doors, the way what I'm getting is the fact that people are absolutely fed up and they want an opportunity to go to the polls. Yeah, and I guess, Michael, that I would say that. But in relation to this particular issue, nothing shocks me around any of this, about how the system can fail and fall. And, you know, we used to think at least you'd have spinning plates that would at least be caught before they hit the ground. None of that happens at the minute. We have had a system that has failed to plan. Yeah. We've had a system, even when planning is in place, that cannot provide buildings. And we have left teachers and we have left principals and we have left, as you say, school managers in a circumstance where they're giving, at some times, the best information they can, which then turns out to be wrong, and everything is put back by a year or two, or in this case, 8 years. And then you have parents who suddenly have to become advocates, parents who have to become campaigners, and then you have us bringing it up, and that's all well and good. But really what you need is systemic change. You need a system that works. And some of this is very, very simple.
Yeah, but what's going
to
happen?
You know the population.
Yeah, but what's going to happen? I want to ask you about the problem that's staring us in the face right now. The most obvious problem in relation to this, and that's this new influx of residents, potentially 20,000 people moving into 5,000 houses in Drogheda. If we look at the region, just to recap, as things stand, if they're looking for a place for one of their children in secondary school, there's a chance that there might be a place in the De La Salle or in Vincent's in Dundalk, but that's not known. There quite possibly will be a place in St. Joseph or in the Bush, I should have mentioned there as well. That's not known either. After that, you're talking about St. Joseph's in Navan or Scullyvere in Dunleer. And if you're talking about 20,000 people moving into these 5,000 houses, we're talking about a minimum of 5,000 children, as many as 10,000 children arriving here without a school place. So what's going to happen? Will they just put more prefabs into the schools, or will their parents be forced to homeschool?
Well, look here, it won't work in relation to homeschooling. Obviously, you're talking about parents that most likely, one or even more likely, both of them are out and working, you know what I mean? And they're put, you know, they're pinned to their collar in relation to covering the bills, covering the mortgages on these new houses and all the rest of it. If they're lucky enough to be in a position where they can actually purchase or they have a rent that they can actually afford. So look, in real terms, what we're dealing with now is what has been absolutely shown, that the system in relation to planning for future school places isn't there, and the admission system is a complete mess. I'm obviously making my interactions, I will be bringing this up from a point of view of, show me the review that's going to happen very fast in relation to the system that pertains at the minute, and what system can we put in place that can at least address these needs, and see if there is a need in certain schools, certain places, certain times. But not only do you need, and I know that prefabs are very different than what they used to be, but if we need prefabs and we need longer term building, it needs to happen as soon as is feasible. And beyond that, we also need to make sure we have the teachers, we have the SNAs, and we have the system in relation to dealing not only with students and also with those students with additional needs. And sometimes we need to look at the overall, as I say, admissions process in relation to schools knowing who's going to be coming through their doors or applying at an earlier stage, being able to process. And as I say, I have a particular issue in the sense that schools often do not have the capacity when they deal with the CDNTs, primary care or whoever else, that they can get the assessments done and that they can get the resources that they need for those kids. But at this stage, you know, for those kids with additional needs, but across the board, it's looking like we mightn't have any room at the inn. Now, what we need is, we need the Department of Education, we need the Minister for Education to state exactly how they're going to deal with this particular circumstance. Because it's all well and good me dealing with this, it's all well and good me bringing this up, it's all well and good me or somebody else like me highlighting it. It's up to government. They have the power between themselves and the department to ensure that they put a system in place that will actually work. And at this point in time, we don't have a huge amount of time for kicking around and, you know what I mean, and mulling over best ideas. But we're not talking about something that's beyond us, that's beyond government, to actually say, here are the kids that we have on the system. Here is where they live. We can't have them traipsing the whole way across the county or into other counties and travelling ridiculous amount of miles. So how can we best fulfil the needs that we have, and how can we put a plan in place in relation to at least, as I say, making sure we will deliver new schools, or we will deliver additions to schools where we need them. And then the other one is, we need to make sure that we don't have hold-ups that relate to planning or relate to the way that they are managing bills at this point in time, which is utterly ridiculous. And see, for all the issues that we bring up in the Dáil, I have far more where teachers and principals and others have come to me and said they don't want the issue highlighted. They always have a fear sometimes they'll annoy somebody in the department or whatever, and they just want their issue rectified. So there's far more issues that you're trying to deal with by having a word in a minister's ear, by talking to an official, by liaison with Louth County Council, who in fairness are, you know, don't want to be the hold up in relation to planning processes or whatever. But all of it is not conducive to producing what is needed for kids out there. You know, and this is long before we talk about, you know, class sizes. This is long before we talk about actually delivering an education system that works, and that we ensure that we have all the roadmaps and for people into further education, into into employment, and here into building these, you know what I mean, into apprenticeships and building the houses that we actually
and it's
need.
It's not just the school places; it's everything that, else. In the case of the Northern Cross access route, what about the GPs? Will hospital capacity increase? I don't think so. What about
beyond GPs? GPs, because that's an issue I brought up a number of times. And the only positive I had was Stephen Donnelly saying that they're looking at GPs on some level being state employed. But the fact is, we know that the old model in relation to GPs hasn't worked. We know we need to train more. We know that we will need them to be working out of primary care centres and whatever. We know people don't want to be running their own business. They want to be direct employees and to be able to deal with with patients, and also it would mean we would be taking some of the pressure off what's happening in A&Es, where people think they have to go to an A&E. Sometimes they think the best bet is to actually ring an ambulance, and that shouldn't happen, but we know it's all happening at the minute, and it creates a greater level of difficulty. It has been an utter failure to plan. But even at this stage, we know we have to set it in train in relation to training GPs. Mm. We need to set up a different model in relation to how they work. And that's even before we get near the fact of the issues people have with medical care.
Yeah, well, maybe the new Taoiseach will focus on this and get it all sorted out.
I wouldn't bet on it. I haven't seen any of the priorities that would be the priorities that we would have at the minute. And from my talking to people out there on the streets in Dundalk and beyond it, they want to see an election, and they're not into Fine Gael determining who the next Taoiseach is. And that should be an answer. And that should be a question that also was going out to every Fianna Fáiler or any independent that is willing to support this government the next time that we go into Leinster House. Mm. We need a change of government. People are demanding it, and we need a system that works better for all of us across the board. That means planning, and that means an ability to follow through. And we've had failure here in relation to education. We've had failure in relation to housing. Mm. We've had failure in relation to health. And here I could probably talk for
perhaps
40
so, but there's been a lot of successes, and we haven't heard from too many people calling for a general election. Has to be said, we've had a few calls.
Well, I have, Michael. Yeah. And you could say I would say that, but these are people.
What I was going to say was that when the public mood is as strong as you're portraying it to be, usually we'd be flooded with calls. Now we've had some calls, and I'm not saying otherwise, but we haven't been flooded with calls from people calling for a general election. I think people, to a large degree, think, well, I wish they'd get on with it. Maybe they're thinking, I wish they'd do a better job of it. But do we really need to go through all of that stuff again? Because we know what's involved in that stuff. We'll have an election, and then 3 or 4 months from now, we'll still be without a government as all of the wrangling goes on. And eventually then we'll just have another team take over. The jerseys will be swapped and we'll be back to the same old.
I have no doubt that they would like government to do better across the board. I have no doubt. But all I am telling you, and this may become more real on the day that we're called in to vote for what is technically a new government, you know, in the sense of a new Taoiseach, and then you have to reinstate all the ministers, and there may be a bit of chopping and chasing, you know, in relation to that. Sure, you can hear that stuff in the public domain at the minute. But first and foremost, people, what I am getting, and I am not in any way messing around with you, it is what I'm getting on the doors. And here, you get this satisfaction with politicians across the board because they're absolutely fed up, because they want to change and they haven't seen it, and they're absolutely fed up that it hasn't happened. But what I am hearing is, we are not interested in having another Fine Gael Taoiseach. What we want is, we want people to have to go to the government, to go to the people, and that the people will make that determination. And that's where you will get authority. That's where you will get support if you want to be a government, if you want to be the Taoiseach. And I do not think that Simon Harris will be able to turn around what has been the abject failure of Fianna Fáil, Fine Gael, the Greens.
Time will tell.
Over many, many years.
No doubt.
Yeah, well, look, we all know what should be happening. We would need to see that happening one way or another. But I am saying at this point in time, the only way that we can get any meaningful change is that we actually change the government.
All right. We've run way over time. Thanks very much for all of the time you've given us today, and indeed for joining us on the programme. That's Rory O'Murricu, Sinn Féin TD for Louth and East Meath. I don't know what you think. As I said to him, we haven't got that sense from our lines. And our lines are open, 0419832000 if you want to ring us, text or WhatsApp 0861800658, email michael@lmfm.ie.
Michael Reid on LMFM.
Thanks to Eamon in Dunleer, who says, Michael, you're always going on about building schools. I don't know where that came from. I don't know why you say that, Eamon, but anyway, he does. He says, you're always going on about building schools. It's about time you started talking about building prisons, because, by God, the way this country is going, we're going to need plenty of them. The government is a joke. Houses here, houses there, no foundations for the future in 5 years' time. What sort of hoop will this little island be in? Thanks very much, as I say, for your message, Eamon in Dunleer. Now, we've heard a lot over the last 24 hours about the United Nations Security Council resolution calling for a ceasefire in Gaza. What does it mean? Well, probably or possibly very little, for the moment at least. Does add to the momentum, but quite likely I think you'd expect the Israelis just to simply ignore that resolution and be in defiance of the wishes of the United Nations, all 15 bar one, the United States. And it's been a long time coming. For 6 months at this stage, the United Nations has been asked to make such a call for a ceasefire in Gaza.
It has taken 6 months. Over 100,000 Palestinians killed and maimed, 2 million displaced, and famine for this council to finally demand an immediate ceasefire. A vote for humanity to prevail, for life to prevail. The Palestinians in Gaza pleaded and appealed, shouted, cried, cursed, prayed, defied the odds to survive time and time again, and yet continue to face death, destruction and displacement, deprivation and disease, and an occupation made famine. They are bombed, besieged, buried under the rubble of the houses they had built. They are killed in their homes, in the streets, in hospitals, in ambulances, in UN shelters, and even in tents. Their ordeal must come to an end, and must come to an immediate end now. As we speak, families prepare to break their fast, missing loved ones around the table, and they may well find nothing to put on their children's plate. In fact, there is no home sheltering them. There is no table to gather around, and there, and no plates to fill and no food to eat. They lost their homes. They lost loved ones. Some of them still trapped under the rubble. Imagine being a parent with kids under the rubble and others alive, feeling broken, but forced to go on for those who remained. Yesterday, Palestinian Christians celebrated Palm Sunday in besieged and destroyed churches that have become shelters in Gaza. They gathered, surrounded by death and praying for resurrection. Palestinian families cannot mourn or heal. They have to find a way to survive and help what is left of their family survive. Mr. President, when such atrocities are being committed in broad daylight against defenseless civilians, including women and children, the right thing to do, the only thing to do morally, legally, politically, is to put an end to it. There can be no justification for war crimes, crimes against humanity, and genocide. Accepting any justification for such crimes is renouncing our humanity and destroying the rule of international law beyond repair.
The stark reality of life today in Gaza, spelled out for us by Riyad Mansour, who is the Palestinian ambassador to the United Nations.
Michael Reed on LMFM.
Time now, as is usual around this time on a Tuesday, for our weekly visit to the Garda Crime Desk. As usual, there's a number of incidents Garda are investigating, and hopefully you can assist with those investigations. Garda Kate Patterson of the Community Policing Unit in Dundalk joins us for this week's report, and thank you for doing so, and good morning to you. We're going to begin with a burglary that happened more than 2 weeks ago, Saturday 2 weeks ago, in fact, on the 9th of March. This occurred in Kilcurry and was a particularly violent affair.
Good morning, Michael. Yes, so we're going to start off with what was an aggravated burglary in Kilcurry, as you said, on Saturday the 9th of March. Detectives attached to Dundalk Garda Station are currently investigating this incident. It took place at St Bridget's Parochial House, Kilcurry, at 8:30 a.m. on that evening, Saturday the 9th of March. During what was an extremely traumatising and frightening incident, four men armed with axes and sledgehammers forced entry into the dwelling before threatening the occupants, demanding that they hand over any money in their possessions and that they hand over the keys to the safe. During the course of the burglary, approximately €3,000 worth of cash was stolen, and following the incident, both occupants of the parochial house as well as the surface of the safe were sprayed with bleach. The culprits escaped by forcing their way through a window to the rear of the property, and we do believe at this stage that they fled the scene by car. So we're seeking anyone who may have been in the vicinity of St Bridget's parochial house on Saturday the 9th of March between 8 p.m. and 9:30 p.m. and who noticed any persons acting suspiciously or a vehicle which looked out of place, and anyone who may be in possession of CCTV or dash cam footage that could assist the investigation, we urge them to contact Dundalk Garda Station. And the number in Dundalk is 042 938 8400.
The next report is of a break-in to a mobile phone shop. This happened on Wednesday just gone in the town centre in Dundalk, but it's not the first break-in to a mobile phone shop, and indeed the two incidents that you have to report on today were early morning break-ins.
That's right, Michael. So once again, the detective unit in Dundalk are investigating two separate burglaries of mobile phone shops. Both burglaries took place in Dundalk town centre just over a week apart, with the first incident taking place at 4 a.m. in the early hours of March the 11th. Now, March the 11th was a Monday morning, and it was the Monday just after Mother's Day. In this incident, we believe that two suspects were involved. We believe that they were male and dressed in dark coloured tracksuits. The pair forced their way into the premises via the front entrance, which is opposite the well-known St Nicholas's Church, and proceeded to take over €12,000 worth of smartphones. This premises is located in Dundalk at the bottom of the town, opposite St Nicholas's Church. A dark-coloured vehicle, of which we're unaware of the make and model, which was in the vicinity at the time, may perhaps be linked. The second incident now, it took place in the early hours of Wednesday just past the 20th of March at 3:30 a.m. And on this occasion, a premises on the corner of Park Street and the Domain was targeted. Entry was gained in a similar fashion to the previous burglary, with the front door being forced open and damaged as a result. In this incident, a number of items were stolen from a display cabinet before the suspects made good their escape. Now, in this incident, we believe that three intruders were involved. All had their faces covered with scarves and all were wearing gloves. We're not sure at this stage if these incidents are connected, but we are urging listeners who may have been in Dundalk Town Centre in the early hours of Monday the 11th of March in Bridge Street and Wednesday the 20th of March in Park Street, we're asking them to contact us if they believe they have either witnessed any persons or vehicles acting suspiciously or captured anything which looked out of place on the dash cam. The detective unit in Dundalk are investigating these incidents and other burglaries which have taken place in Dundalk over the last number of weeks. We have seen a rise in burglaries over the last couple of weeks. We would ask anyone who can assist us or any of our investigations to contact Dundalk Garda Station. If you feel you can assist the investigation and you want to stay confidential, as always, use the Garda Confidential line, and it is 1800 666 111.
Our next report relates to a number of thefts, items stolen across County Meath and Stamullen, Clonay and in Donore. There's a lot of similarities between these incidents, isn't there, Garda?
There is, and we're seeing a rise in this type of incident as well, Michael. So I suppose if we look at the Ashburn district today, they have noticed a significant rise in the amount of thefts from vehicles, specifically in the last month.
Three such incidents took place in the last week, one in Orchard Rise in Stamullen, one in Somerset Drive in Cluny, and another in the Grange in Donore. All three incidents, the suspect proceeded to gain entry to the vehicle by breaking either a side or a fly window. Personal items and small change were stolen. That's what these thieves are targeting. They're stolen from glove boxes and central consoles in the vehicles. And all of these thefts took place in the hours of darkness between 11 p.m. and 7 a.m. So the Gardaí in Ashburn are urging the public to ensure that no monies or items of value are left visible in your vehicle during the hour of darkness. If it's possible, we would ask you to park your vehicle in a secure area and perhaps look at maybe installing a sensor light or CCTV in a bid to deter these criminals. If anyone in the Ashburn area can assist or provide any information regarding these investigations, please get in touch with the Gardaí in Ashburn. The number there is 01-801-0600.
We're going to Dundalk for the next report, which must have been a particularly frightening incident for a woman working in a shop on the St. Alphonse's Road. Gardaí are treating this very seriously, I think.
Yes, Michael, as you say, this was incredibly frightening for the young lady involved. The detectives in Dundalk are investigating this incident and we're seeking assistance from the public in gathering any potential evidence. This incident was a robbery, the robbery of a shop on St. Alphonse's Road just on Thursday the 21st of March, and it took place just before 9 a.m. So lots of your listeners may have been using the roads in this area, may have been walking to school, walking to work, bringing their children to school. In this case, a lone male who concealed his identity with a hoodie and a snood entered the shop and produced a knife. He threatened a female shop assistant, demanding that she open the till. Now, the assistant fled from the shop and the assailant chased her before finally giving up and running away. The detective unit in Dundalk would like to speak to anyone who may have been in the St. Alphonse's Road, the Marshes or the Avenue Road areas that morning, that last Thursday between the hours of 8:30 a.m. and 9:30 a.m. Now, if you've seen anybody acting suspiciously, you know, you might have captured somebody running from the scene on your mobile phone or on your car's dash cam, or you may have witnessed the person running from this shop. If so, we would urge you to contact the detectives in Dundalk. I'll just give you the number for Dundalk again. Mm-hmm. It's 042-938-8400.
Okay, and we're going to conclude today with a word of warning about nitrous oxide.
Yes, Michael. So we're continuing to warn young people of the risks that are associated with nitrous oxide due to an increase in its use within our communities. The selling and illegal use of nitrous oxide canisters for human consumption is a very serious offence, contrary to Section 3 of the Psychotic Substances Act 2010, and it poses serious risks to health. Now, nitrous oxide, which is known on the streets as laughing gas, whippets, balloons, hippie crack, amongst others, can be extremely dangerous and in some cases has caused death. In particular in Meath, community workers are finding in excess of 300 empty nitrous oxide canisters per week and reported recent discoveries in Navan, Kells, Stamullen, Donore and the Leek. The effects of consumption of nitrous oxide can include dizziness, hallucinations, shortness of breath, frostbite injuries, nerve damage and in severe cases loss of consciousness, suffocation and heart attacks and ultimately death. So if you do come across anybody who's become ill after consuming this or any other drug, or if you're in the presence of someone who may be ill as a result of drug misuse, we would please, please urge you to contact the emergency services immediately. And if you do come across any discarded nitrous oxide canisters in your area, or if you're aware of somebody who's trying to sell this product to young people, we would urge you to please contact us immediately. And, you know, you can always remain anonymous. You can report this to your local station or you can get in touch by using our confidential line and the number 1800-666-111.
Garda Kate Patterson of the Community Policing Unit in Dundalk. Thank you indeed. We'll return to the Garda Crime Desk in around the same time on next Tuesday's programme. That's our programme for today, though. God willing, we'll see you for our next programme tomorrow morning at 9 a.m. right here on LMFM. Good morning. Bye-bye.
The Michael Reid Show podcast. Tune in weekdays from 9 on LMFM. To contact us, email now, michael@lmfm.ie.
Selling a little or a lot? Shopify helps you do your thing however you cha-ching. Shopify is the global commerce platform that helps you sell at every stage of your business. From the launch your online shop stage to the first real-life store stage. All the way to the did we just hit a million orders stage. Shopify is there to help you grow. Shopify helps you turn browsers into buyers with the internet's best converting checkout. 36% better on average compared to other leading commerce platforms. Because businesses that grow, grow with Shopify. Get a $1 per month trial period at shopify.com/work. Shopify.com/work.
Tired of ads intruding into your favorite comedy podcasts? Good news. Ad-free listening is available on Amazon Music for all the music plus top podcasts included with your Prime membership. Dive into a world of laughs by downloading the Amazon Music app for free. Or go to amazon.com/comedyadfree. That's amazon.com/comedyadfree to catch up on the latest episodes without the ads.